You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
During his over three decades in Washington, D.C., Chris Matthews has done just about everything from working as a police officer to being a speechwriter for Jimmy Carter. These days, of course, he's the host of some shows, Hardball on MSNBC and The Chris Matthews Show on NBC. He's also written a number of books over the years. His latest is Life is a Campaign, What Politics Has Taught Me About Friendship, Rivalry, Reputation, and Success. It's published by Random House, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Chris Matthews back to my show. Hello.
Thanks, Leonard.
Should I take your title seriously, Life is a Campaign? What do you mean by that?
Well, so much of life is trying to get along with people, just trying to build friendships. I mean, if life isn't about friendships, I don't know what it is. And if it's not about rivalry, I've missed it. It's about friendship. And these people that you end up having to be rivals with, you don't want to be rivals, but somebody wants what you want. And of course, it's about reputation. It's about how people look at you. And I found that there's traits, and these are good traits, that some politicians have that you can learn from. They're very helpful and they're positive. They're not what you think.
Well, there was a sense that in the old days, I'm sure it was never 100% true, but that Republicans and Democrats could be friends when they weren't arguing about political things. And today, there seems to be an awful lot of hatred across the aisles.
And it's not that they're better at their philosophies either. It's not like they're good at the bad stuff. Or, you know, I have a story in the book about, and this will surprise a lot of libs and conservatives, when Ronald Reagan was near death and he was in much worse shape than the White House put out at the time in 1981 when he was shot in the attempted assassination, he was lying at George Washington Hospital where they did a great job to save him. And so did the Secret Service guy, Jerry Parr, who got him there. And he was convalescing in the first couple of weeks. And Jim Baker, who was an excellent chief of staff and hardly a right winger, he let Tip O'Neill in to see Ronald Reagan. So he let the leader of the opposition as the first guy to see the ailing president, which I thought was great ritual for our country. And one of the people watching him was one other guy in the room, Friedersdorf, Max Friedersdorf, who's the chief of congressional relations for the White House. He watched Tip on his knees next to Reagan's bed, kneeling down. He saw him kiss Reagan, and then he saw them holding hands, and he listened to them as they recited the 23rd Psalm together. You know, that to me is a sacrament, the fact that people who really disagreed with each other had this common humanity, and nobody ever talked about it. No one ever, in all the years those guys were alive, ever advertised that fact. They never mentioned it. I worked for Tip every day for 6 years, and I never heard him say anything about that. And it's just a personal, I don't know, it's just a personal moment that I think tells us you can be better than you seem in politics.
I can't imagine Newt Gingrich or Dennis Hastert or Nancy Pelosi doing something like that.
Well, I can't imagine a relationship like that either. And I think that although they disagreed, and I worked for Tip on the liberal side of things, and we fought the good fight every day and tried to win it every day. I can tell you tried to win it every day, that both men were better for the rivalry. It's one thing about Democratic politics, that if both sides argue a philosophical issue, the country's better for that. And we've lost that ability to argue. This arguing over Rush Limbaugh's comments yesterday, the sort of the down marketing of this, what did Monahan call it? Declining deviancy downward. It's just they're arguing about things that are just not worthy of public discussion at
but
this
point.
But
that's because it's payback for the discussion of the Petraeus thing, which also shouldn't have happened. But that's and when you look at the way the press is covering this election, it's all about who's ahead in the polls and who's collected the most money. And it's so little about issues. It's about John Edwards' haircut, things like that.
Well, you know, I think I was thinking back. Yeah, I spoke to a bunch of people at the 21 Club yesterday morning, so I stayed up late the night before trying to think what's missing. In every great change election, and this has been advertised as a change election, it's certainly the opportunity for a big change. The candidate who won, whether it's FDR in 32 or even Ike in 52 or Kennedy in 60 or Reagan in 80, always offered deliverance, some change from the place we are to another place. And they had a structure for doing it. Of course, Roosevelt had to experiment, but Ike said, I will go to Korea. Kennedy said, I'll create the Peace Corps, the Alliance for Progress, whole new international relationships. Reagan, like it or not, said, I'll cut the government taxes. I'll cut the size of government. I'll increase spending on strategic weaponry to maybe force an end to this Cold War, whatever. They had a structure to carry out their promise of deliverance. This campaign not only lacks those proposals that are tangible, but there's no promise of deliverance. Hillary's run a very impressive campaign, but I haven't met a single person who has said it's been an inspiring campaign. Rudy has been very functional, but there's no inspiration. There's nobody saying, I can't wait for the Rudy presidency. I can't wait for the Hillary presidency. There's no inspiration here because there's no promise of deliverance.
But you've been very positive about Rudy among
I have been positive about his prospects.
He said he looks like president to me, and then a few months later in 2006 on The Tonight Show, you predicted he'd win in 2008.
Oh, yeah.
And you said, I hope the American people take the next election very seriously and don't just vote partisan or personality or who has the happiest smile, but picks the person that makes us feel the safest, which sounds to me like an endorsement.
Well, it's going to be.
It's
not, first of all, I'm not endorsing, and I'd probably vote for Hillary right now, but the fact is that I am an independent. And I do think Rudy will win the nomination of the Republican Party. And I think a lot of my buddies who are liberals who grew up in Democratic families don't know what a Republican is. Republicans are different culturally than Democrats. Democrats like meetings. They like having a person chair the meeting. They like to have everybody have their say in a kind of a collegial way. Republicans don't want any of that. They want a leader to come in and tell them. As my editor says, Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line. And Rudy is a leader.
Well,
you don't have to like him.
But then you also said about John McCain that he was with a panel on November 2006. He's passionate, a smart hawk, kind of Martin Luther. John McCain certainly deserves to be president, you once said, based on his contribution to this country over the years. And you say you
deserves. Yeah, I didn't say he should be. I said he has met the sufficiency, the necessary conditions to be president. There's a lot of people that deserve to be president. One's going to be.
My guest is Chris Matthews. He's written a book called Life's a Campaign, What Politics Has Taught Me About Friendship, Rivalry, Reputation, and Success. It's published by Random House. Well, should we listen to something that you said about Hillary Clinton?
Depends when.
Put on your headphones,
sure,
okay?
Sure, let's listen. Okay, let's put the gender thing in here. I love gender politics, guys. We have two women here all the time to make sure we're balanced on this show. But Elizabeth, I know you're a feminist in the best possible sense of that word. You probably are in a more traditional way.
Totally. I pay my own bills.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that. I am stunned that these Last Supper scenes where the Last Supper in history was all men. Every scene you see with Hillary is a lunch. And it's all women. She is advertising her sisterhood. Is that something that she can use to help sell herself as a future strong person defending this country? Or is it getting in the way? Elizabeth?
No, I don't think it gets in the way. It's the base of her support. That's how she won in New York. She won because of women.
When it comes down to that final decision to vote for president, a woman commander-in-chief, will be an historic decision for people.
Absolutely.
Not just men, but women as well. Elizabeth, you're always thinking about these things.
But Golda Meir, Margaret Thatcher, I mean, we all remember these women. I think we can get there.
But we got Patton and John Wayne on our side.
Patton and Wayne on our side?
On men's side, yeah. I was obviously speaking conceptually about gender. And I'll tell you, the big question mark of this country has come next October when I believe Hillary will confront the Republican candidate in three nights of debate. We will be looking to see who has the medal and who has the sweat. And whoever sweats will probably lose. I've been saying on my program, if it's Rudy versus Hillary, my bet is that Rudy will be the one sweating. That Hillary will be the one confident.
But isn't it interesting that when Hillary does things that come across as feminine, that people make fun of her? And when she does things where she really shows strength and they say, well, you know, she's mannish. Sometimes they even suggest that she might be a lesbian.
Well, she's denied that, of course.
Yeah, well, of course. But I mean,
look, it's a new
she's
world.
She's caught in a bind.
It's
there,
a new world for us. Even in the Constitution, the 15th Amendment that allowed recent slaves to vote, male slaves, was 1870. Women didn't get the right to vote from men until 1920, 50 years later. There is a primordial condition in our country, and if you don't look at it honestly, I don't think you're doing what the Clintons are doing, which is looking at it honestly. We don't know how it's going to pop next year. It could be the great year of change. It could be when the guys with guns in Michigan and boats and certain attitudes about women in Pennsylvania and places like that simply secretly go into that voting booth and vote for Rudy or some Republican, never telling the pollsters they're going to do it. We don't know that answer.
How did you wind up working for all these Democrats over the years? Your brother has run as a Republican.
He's a moderate Republican, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, he was Lynn Swann's running mate.
Right.
For lieutenant governor.
I've been voting
in Pennsylvania.
I have been what I am since I began to vote.
You went to the Peace Corps,
right?
In Africa, and then instead of going back to Philadelphia, you went to Washington. Why?
I went to get into politics. I really wanted to.
That's
went
what
to
you always wanted to do?
I always wanted to do. I worked for Frank Moss from Utah. He's one of the last liberals out there. And then I worked for Muskie, who I thought was fabulous. And then I worked for Carter. And then I was
when Carter was running for president.
No, I actually worked. Actually, I contributed to Mo Udall's campaign, actually. But when I got into, when Carter took office, I was able to get a job with Carter. And then I worked for Tip as AA for 6 years, every day with him.
And you just showed up in Washington without any connections?
Well, I really
was. Is that a little naive?
I was naive, but I kept knocking on doors. I had this strategy I write about in the book where I go, I don't know anybody, but I went to Holy Cross, a Jesuit college in Massachusetts. I'm Irish Catholic. I went to Peace Corps. And I just said, well, who's likely to sort of like the cut of my jib on first instance? And I went to all these Irish Catholic politicians on the East Coast on foreign relations, foreign affairs. And then that wasn't working. They all had connections and people to look after. And finally, I knocked on the door. I said, well, a Western Democrat like Frank Moss is probably a moderate Democrat, somebody a little bit more like me. I'm not a lefty. And maybe this will be good for me. And he was anti-war and everything. And I thought, and it turns out that his top guy gave me the interview. And he had just worked for Ted Kennedy. And he had been Bobby Kennedy's Western States coordinator. And he liked the whole, we just clicked. And then I ended up getting a job as a cop at night and then finally getting a real job as legislative assistant.
And you're not the only person who worked as a cop. Harry Reid worked
Harry
as a,
Reid
a,
was
cop
a cop
in Washington, D.C. And he used it in his campaign
Nevada. Attorney General of Nevada. Because you know the notion of Washington as being this tough town with lots of crime fed the image of being a tough cop. And there's Harry Reid, a kind of a soft-spoken guy, going out to Nevada. Yeah, I was back east. I was there in Washington as a cop, a street cop. We were both Capitol Police. Let's not overdo this thing.
And what is a Capitol Police?
Well, you guard the Capitol and you walk around with a gun and you look like a policeman. But in most cases, in Harry's case and in my case, we had very little training, a week of training, one day on the firing range. I was very lucky. And I didn't really pass, but they passed me. I wasn't that good with a gun. I'm glad I never had to use it, I can tell you that. I did guard the Pentagon Papers one night. I wrote about it. I mean, here I am sitting there
against Daniel Ellsberg
with a loaded gun and a uniform on and short hair. And there's a little room. And they said the Pentagon Papers are in there. We didn't even know the term for them at then. And it turns out they'd already been in the Times and the Washington Post. And here I am guarding with my life and my gun the Pentagon Papers. I thought it was a pretty good introduction to D.C., that one.
You're right that a lot of your success is attributed to being able to walk through a series of open doors. But you also write that when a door opens, you have to remember the person who's opening it for you.
Yeah, human beings, human relations. And, you know, I try to remember people that gave me a break, and Frank Moss and Wayne Owens and Ed Muskie and Tip. And I really try to – you'll notice that my loyalties – are very personal to people and not very partisan. I tend to vote Democrat, in fact, except one occasion or two occasions or maybe three in my whole lifetime, one on president.
Well, somebody's going to do an investigation right now. They did it to O'Reilly after he made some kind of a nonpartisan claim.
No,
and
I don't.
He was
I don't,
embarrassed.
I voted for Arlen Specter, first time I ever voted for anybody, for mayor of Philadelphia because I thought he'd be a reformer. He's a moderate Republican. I voted for Bush the first time. I voted for Michael Steele because I think we need African Americans in the U.S. Senate. I think it's rotten that we don't. I think in this country, I'll just say it, I'm going to keep voting black until we get some blacks in the Senate. And I don't care whether they're Republican or Democrat. It's an insult to this country. We have a reasonable number of ethnic people from different groups in the Senate now. We have a reasonable number of women. We have a totally unreasonable number of blacks. One. It's a joke in a country with 11% of the voting population black, and we have one senator.
And he's trying to become president.
Well, I would be in heaven if he made it, but I think it's a long shot right now.
The only one you don't seem to mention when you talk about all the people you admire is Jimmy Carter. Did you come to not admire him when you
no,
were
No, I think he's what he is. I mean, Len, you know he's controversial, and he loves being controversial. His book on apartheid in Israel were clearly aimed at causing trouble and making noise, and in fact... Jonathan Demme made a movie about him going around causing trouble. I mean, Carter loves to be a tumbler. It's a good Yiddishism.
I was supposed to be in that film. I think they
He loves causing trouble. He loves being a pain in the butt to the president. He doesn't like Bush, obviously. I would take him to Bush any day in terms of his sense of the world. I think he's a humble man, and I think we could use some humility. By the way, the reason I voted for Bush is, you remember, he ran and said, I'm going to bring some humility to our foreign policy. And that grabbed a lot of people who are liberals. They said, wait, maybe that is the answer. Stop being the intellectual, you know, best and brightest and rule the world. Why don't we pay attention to the rest of the world?
Well, you were in the minority because Al Gore did win that election.
I wasn't in the popular vote minority. I agree. And by the way, covering the recount was still something that's not clear. But if Al Gore had asked for a total recount of Florida, he'd be president. He didn't ask for a total recount. He was cute. And that's, people forget that about Al. He's just too cute.
Also, the Supreme Court made a decision.
Well, because he didn't ask for a total recount. A total recount would have forced all the votes out. And I think and Lieberman didn't help too much when he talked about the servicemen's votes all being counted. That didn't help in Clark County, one of those counties.
My guest is Chris Matthews. He's written a book called Life's a Campaign, What Politics Has Taught Me About Friendship, Rivalry, Reputation, and Success. It is published by Random House. We will continue our conversation after this. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast. We're back with Chris Matthews, who's the star of MSNBC's Hardball and NBC's The Chris Matthews Show, a contributor frequently to NBC's Today, and also a familiar guest on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. His latest book, Life's a Campaign, What Politics Has Taught Me About Friendship, Rivalry, Reputation, and Success, is published by Random House. And you say that Carter's candidacy in 1976 taught you something about conventional wisdom in Washington.
Isn't
conventional wisdom always wrong?
It's always wrong. It's always wrong. Like, Rudy can't possibly be the Republican nominee. Can't possibly be. This war is necessary back in 2002. We have to do this. I mean, It is a good bet to bet against CW. It's a good bet. I'm not saying it's always right, but it's a pretty good bet. And my instinct is, my job is not to tout or toot the horn of what everybody else is saying. I can't believe, I'm sure you have them, guests that come on my show on Hardball and actually speak as if with originality, the exact talking points that everybody's saying at every party I go to. I go, well, why are you necessary if all you're going to do is that? I can't talk like that, but that is my mood. My attitude.
And we hear them again and again, all these pundits who tell us what all the other pundits have told us, as though, as you say, it's an original thought. But people like you put them on the show.
Well, we have to. I put people on the show I don't spend a lot of time with otherwise, but, you know, they are voices. But, you know, for example, I was saying I grew up in a Republican family, as you point out, and they were all Republicans. My dad was a big – even voted for Goldwater. You know, I don't think he was that far over.
Well, so did Hillary.
He was loyal to Goldwater. And I was part of that when I was a kid, and I changed over civil rights primarily, and of course over the Vietnam War. And I just said, I mean, I just didn't think the Republican Party was moving. And of course, the Kennedy assassination. I know it's not an intellectual event, but the phenomenon of that death to everybody my age, it just changed me. I just had some different sentiment afterwards. Everybody says 9/11 changes everything. No, the Kennedy assassination to me changed everything and created the 60s. There wouldn't have been a 60s without the Kennedy assassination. It just made people look at everything in authority and question it again.
One of the pundits you have had on your show is Michelle Malkin.
Oh, God.
Can we play a little clip?
Oh, you're so sweet. You're so sweet.
This was about the Swift Boat veterans attacks on John Kerry.
Oh, God, here we go.
Are you saying I want an answer, yes or no, Michelle?
Some of the veterans say
Been shooting himself on purpose. I've never heard that.
Self-inflicted wounds on February 1969.
This show is not a show for this kind of talk. Are you accusing him of shooting himself on purpose to avoid combat or to get credit?
I am saying
give me the name.
Patrick Runyon and William Zeldonis
Patrick Runyon. They said he shot himself on purpose to avoid combat or to take credit for a wound.
These people have cast a lot of doubt on whether or not
a lot of doubt is just complete nonsense. Did anyone read the statement from you on this program say to me right now that you believe he shot himself to get credit for a Purple Heart?
I'm not sure. I am saying that.
Then why'd you say it?
Because I'm talking about what's in the book.
What is in the book? Is there a direct accusation in any book you've ever read in your life that said John Kerry shot himself on purpose to get a credit for Purple Heart? On purpose. Yes or no, Michelle?
There are doubts about whether or not there was intense rifle fire or not.
I wish you would
ask these questions of John Kerry.
I have never heard anyone say he shot himself on purpose.
Have you tried to ask John Kerry these questions?
If he shot himself on purpose? No, I have not asked him that.
Don't you wonder?
No, I don't. It's never occurred to me.
The idea that somebody would take a rocket-propelled grenade and aim it at themselves is so ludicrous. And yet the people on the right who swift-voted John Kerry were able to get that into our bloodstream totally, totally fallaciously. And they wouldn't say it. They used this phrase self-inflicted. Was it a ricochet? What was it? The gun misfired?
He jumped in front of the shell.
But they won't say it because they know once they make the clear accusation, they've got to defend it. So what they do is they say, oh, have you asked him? It's in the book and blah, blah, blah. I said, yuck, find me the quote. It isn't. It says self-inflicted, which is not helpful.
Well, obviously.
And by the way, you get a
purple
heart.
You caught her in an obvious lie. She was unwilling to concede any ground to you.
I know.
So what do you do when a guest...
Well, there's two kinds of people that come on my program. They're people who have a difference of objective, a different view of what's the truth, and have learned something a different way than I've learned it. We can argue about that. Then there are movement people who come on to move a case, and they're not interested in facts, not interested in the truth. You simply have to address them, confront them, and hopefully expose them as movement people.
And that exchange eventually ended with Malkin posting your personal phone number on her website.
Well, I think she was, and she led a lot to the Zell Miller thing, because when Zell Miller came on, who's apparently been piped into this Swiftboat crowd, poor guy, he served its country, and somehow he got dragged into this. I don't know how he became part of this world. He came on my show and said, I'm not going to let you do what you did to that little girl. First of all, did she sound like a little girl? She sounded like a real grown-up who knew what she was doing, and unfortunately, the movement people are not interested in the truth. They're interested in pushing a story.
But can I? What about trying to not talk over Malkin and just let her talk for a little while, and then you talk for a little while? I've tried that approach. It usually works.
No, I'm not going to let my show become a propaganda machine, and that's what they were going to do.
Well, you've come under fire from the left for inviting Ann Coulter on as a guest so many times.
Well, we challenged her. We had her on two or three times. We had her on with Elizabeth Edwards to challenge her back. And so that her attacks on Elizabeth Edwards were confronted by Elizabeth Edwards. I think that was the way to do it.
Uh-huh. And what is achieved when Ann Coulter and Elizabeth Edwards face down? Elizabeth Edwards looks like the sane person.
A human being can make a human judgment in that case.
Many, if you go to the internet, many of the media watchers are detecting a strong bias toward white males in the show.
Come on.
So it's really weird.
No, because Media Matters says that. Come on, who else? Come on. You know, there's a couple. You know, I get it from Newsbusters every day. I get Newsbusters. You know, I stopped listening to that or reading at night because I would get one whack from the right and one whack from the left every single day based upon the same conversations. You know why? Because that's what they do for a living.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's nothing wrong with it. That's what they do. And everybody wants you to conform. Rush wants you to be a ditto head. The glass menagerie liberals want you to be one of them and be very sacred about the Clintons and careful about their points of view and sell all the latest movements. And my job is to try to be an independent. Just try. My job. I thought Eric Severide once said brilliantly when he was under attack by Spiro Agnew, he said, you know, our job is not to be always accurate, although we try to always be accurate. Our job is not always to be fair, although we try to be fair. But our job is always to be independent.
My guess is, well, first of all, you're doing a talk show. You're not doing a news report. And so you're allowed to...
I know, but I'm trying to deal with facts, too. I really know that I think a lot of people, by the way, you know this, turn on a program like Hardball at 7, and that is their news. They take the news that way. That's the way people get things.
After they get it from John Stewart, they may get it from you.
And they may get it from John. They may get it from listening in the radio all afternoon. I think a good citizen today has to be a distillation. You have to take a lot of points of view that are reasonable and come out with your own resolution.
My guest is Chris Matthews. His book, Life's a Campaign, What Politics Has Taught Me About Friendship, Rivalry, Reputation, and Success, is published by Random House. When you first met Nancy Pelosi 20 years ago, wasn't she supposed to have lunch with you?
Yeah, I use that as an example of a great natural pal who grew up with her father, Tommy D'Agostino, mayor of Baltimore. Her brother was Tommy D'Agostino, brother. And here's what she did. Will Hearst, William Randolph Hearst III, was my boss, the publisher of the San Francisco Examiner. And he had pulled together a lot of people, local politicians like Pete McCloskey, a lot of guys, labor leaders, old lefty labor leaders from Longshoremen, people like Harry Bridges guys. And we're all sitting at the Washbag, the Washington Square Bar and Grill, drinking a lot of white wine back in those days. And Nancy was supposed to come. And she was just elected in a special election to fill Sally Burton's seat. And she called me up and she said, it was so well she said this. She said, I have to do a Chinese event at lunch, but I might be able to make it. I don't know. So I thought that was great because she was basically being courteous to tell me she probably wasn't going to make it, so I wouldn't count on her, and that wouldn't force her to bolt out of that other event, you know, indecorously, and she would be able to actually be a polite guest of her Chinese guest host and then make it to me maybe if she could. Well, what happened was she went to the Chinese event about 1:15. We're sitting there guzzling down these carafes of white wine back in the old days, and there comes this big, bright flash of crimson across Washington Square. It's Nancy making it to my event. So what she did was she set it up so we couldn't count on her, but we might be able to expect her. It's a subtle little thing about the average person would have called up and said, can't make your event. I got to go to this other thing. Or they would have said, I'll be there a little late. But she didn't do that. It's a very subtle thing. She was careful with our feelings and our self-respect, and everybody was happy.
A lot of people predicted, people who were partisan, that when she became House Speaker, things would go crazy. But it hasn't worked out that way. In fact, she's been a lot more restrained than anyone expected, even her strongest supporters.
She's a pro. And I think that although the numbers are down for Congress, the numbers are down for a very profound reason. The Democrats got control of Congress to end the war. They haven't done it. They've got to keep trying. They got to taking the brickbats from people like me and others. They got to keep trying. They got to get better speeches. They got to get better hearings. What they ought to do is what Fulbright did, really good hearings, and really teach us the problems of that war over there, and it's not going to end. But she was very smart to back Jack Murtha. Murtha's
oh,
a good anti-war.
Many people saw that as a mistake.
Mistake. No, she was great because Murtha was one of her chief people to getting her elected to the speakership, and she stuck with him and backed him up. Loyalty is still, even in the 21st century, a major plus for a politician. Be loyal to the guy. And by the way, Murtha is right on the war. He's been right all along. I think he's a great guy.
And Tip O'Neill said, told you that loyalty is the best thing. But can't loyalty to a person or a party or a political idea get in the way of what's really right? I mean, do you think that President Bush's unwavering loyalty to Donald Rumsfeld, to Alberto Gonzalez, and some others has been wise?
He picked the wrong guys to be loyal to. I picked Tip O'Neill and Jack Murtha and Nancy Pelosi. I think the strangest man on the planet. First of all, I sort of figured out the neoconservatives. I've gotten to know them like Wolfowitz. I'm friendly with, but I've figured a lot of them out. I work with some of them, you know, like David Brooks and all the people that think like that and believe in this philosophy of democratization and Wilsonian politics and all that. I have never been able, I figured out Cheney. He just likes to hurt. He likes to be tough. He likes to win. He's a tough guy, control guy. I get all that. But I don't get Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld is this wry, rather pleasant personality. He's got sort of a, you know, Orson Bean sort of manner, sort of intellectual wryness. And when I was over at the Pentagon, I said to him, this is the first time I've been here since I was at the march on the Pentagon. You know, and he laughed. Yeah, you know. And I said, did the president ever ask you if we should invade Iraq? And he gets this sort of interesting look in his eye. He looks up near. He goes, actually, never asked me. This is the president's defense chief. And he's strange. He just is strange. There's no doubt about it. Probably arrogant, but strange. I find him likable, and I despise what the role he played in this war, because he taught the president what he thought would happen, and it didn't happen. He was all wrong.
Why do you think President Bush remained loyal to him and to Gonzalez for so long, way past the time?
Simple-mindedness.
When his own party was
simple-mindedness. A man who has to make simple black and white decisions is always afraid to question them. If you have a mind that says good, bad, right, wrong, it's open to nuance, to change, to understanding. Arthur Schlesinger just died. It's come to all across. I used to think he was very far over on the left side. Arthur was a very moderate guy, a very conservative guy in many ways. Arthur said at a thing I went to an Aspen Institute a couple of years ago. He said, politics is essentially an educational process. You're always learning. You're always developing new information. That's what you every day you meet new people, you try to learn something. This president closed down the door to understanding very early in life, and I think that's a problem.
Well, there are a lot of people have debated over whether George Bush is smart or not so smart. Is that the question, or is really that he has certain ways of dealing with things, and you say they're black and white?
Well, I think if you see him in his press conference, he's very nimble intellectually. It's not a problem of gift. His gift is his problem is curiosity, because you know people that pick up, they can't walk past a newspaper without reading it. They can't get up in the morning without reading as much as they can. They travel as much as they can afford. They want to meet everybody they can. They just love going to foreign countries. They just love meeting interesting people. And there are those who have it all figured out. All they want to do is play golf, you know, and just hang around people of their own class, and they don't want to hear any ideas. Bobby Kennedy was not a genius, but Bobby Kennedy had curiosity. And I think that's what's missing.
You talked about being friendly with Paul Wolfowitz. Some journalists have been accused of being too close to the corridors of power. Judith Miller, somebody you've...
Oh, come on. You're not comparing... Chalabi, the INC.
No, here's
Judy,
what I'm saying.
Judy was very close to that source. There's no doubt about that source.
I shouldn't have brought it up in that way, but... In the end, if you go to parties with people and you
does
go to their homes
does anybody doubt my independence? I mean,
I'm
I
not talking
know.
About you, Chris. I'm asking for you, your assessment, your evaluation
yeah,
of somebody
okay,
who's
okay.
in Washington okay. of the how the press corps has okay. often been very chummy with
I
politicians.
I think the White House press corps has been too nice to Bush. I like the old days when Sam Donaldson there was kicking the president in the groin, when Leslie Stahl was doing the same, when Chris Wallace was doing. There was an old days attitude about the press, which is your job is to challenge the president every day of the week on the facts. Your job is to make people question the president. I don't see that anymore. As I think David Broder was probably right. He's the dean, you know, everybody calls him. And one thing I agree with him on is that,
one thing you, well, you're allowed
agree,
to agree
one thing
with
I agree
on.
With him on. I think he's sometimes, well, we disagree on some things. I don't think he catches some of the reality of politics. He's into the form and all, but I'm not sure he gets the magic of it. He said, keep your distance from everybody. Don't hang out with anybody you cover. Don't have any relationship with them so that when you have to put the knife in, you put it in. I think he's right. It's so hard, by the way. I'm writing a book, and I'm talking about people I know, like John Kerry and people like that. It's very hard to be objective, and it's still I'm tough, but it's, oh, God, he's not going to like this. And you got to live with that. You got to go. George Will, who I don't agree with much, said you got to be able to be a sports reporter that walks right through the dressing room, the locker room, right after you trash the team. You got to be able to walk right through that. That's hard.
I know. It's embarrassing.
It's embarrassing. You feel like
you're just... To be confronted by somebody, do you really feel that way about me, Chris?
You don't like me personally? Yeah, that's how it comes across.
Chris Matthews' fifth book is Life's a Campaign, What Politics Has Taught Me About Friendship, Rivalry, Reputation, and Success. It's published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Great interview. Thank you, sir.
Chris Matthews will be speaking and signing books tonight at 7:30 at the Lincoln Square Barnes & Noble store. That's on Broadway at 66th Street. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also heard on satellite.